Last Tuesday, December the 10th, Elizabeth May, the leader of Canada's National Green Party, made a brief appearance in Halifax while on a stopover en route to Copenhagen. Having been living away from her home of Nova Scotia campaigning in BC, Ms. May jokingly dubbed these few hours in Halifax her Nova Scotia Christmas. Ms. May was greeted by a gaggle of Green Party supporters and gave all in attendance a gift of her experience, knowledge, and sense of humor gleaned from many years as an environmental campaigner. Ms. May's speech succeeded in rallying spirits and giving insight into international negotiations that are often difficult to understand from an average citizen's perspective. To cover the story for ZKDU, I hopped on the dreaded 80 bus from downtown Halifax, met up with a friend in Bedford, and before I knew it, I was setting up to record in a hotel just outside the airport. Not long after I arrived, Ms. May entered the room and began her speech.
Now, one person whose heart understands the conviction and certitude of the stance for humanity's continuation is Elizabeth May. And while from a strictly gender point of view, she can't be considered one of the fathers of the success of our change in awareness, she is a mother of a force to contend with. And she's going to take that to Copenhagen. So ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct pleasure to turn this podium over to the leader of the Green Party of Canada, Elizabeth May.
I want to thank John, and I'm just saying to him, I hope this is the first of many times that we're on the same podium, able to be working together, because for some of you who aren't familiar with the Green Party, and I don't plan to be partisan tonight, at least we can all, you know, unite behind our common conviction that we have the world's worst prime minister, but beyond that, I don't plan to be particularly partisan. I just got an email from one of my friends who's on one of the government delegations, in which he described the scene as a zoo wrapped up in a circus resting in a quagmire. And further went on to say that he'd never in his life been at a climate meeting where he felt jumpy. He said, the Danish security forces are scared stiff. The atmosphere is distrustful and unpleasant. And the prospects at this point, he laid it out pretty clearly. At this point, you know, you'll know that our Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, was basically the last of the representatives at a head of government or head of state to commit to going to Copenhagen. Just so you know, there are over 100 heads of government going to Copenhagen. And I happened to be in Ottawa the day that Barack Obama announced that he would be going to Copenhagen. And it was one of the first times that the leader of the official opposition led off with a climate question and directed it to Stephen Harper and said, now that we know that President Hu of China and President Obama of the United States are going to Copenhagen, and since you, Mr. Prime Minister, have said that you would attend if other world leaders were attending, will you now go? His answer was little reported. He said, I said I would go if there was a meeting of world leaders, but since President Obama is going on December 9th and the others are coming on the 16th, I will not be attending. Now, there was quick focus groups, scratching of the head within PMO. And as his plane took off for Asia, the reporters on board the Prime Minister's plane were quickly, I mean, it's not what you're supposed to do when you're on a plane on takeoff, they were quickly texting and blackberrying back to their offices to say that it had been announced on board the plane that Stephen Harper would attend Copenhagen. So the decision-making process, if any, I've never seen a prime minister do a better kind of through every statement made visual representation of someone dragged kicking and screaming to attend a conference. I mean, it was very clearly the last thing in the world he wanted to have to do. But having stated his objection, not the truth, which is that he doesn't like the United Nations, doesn't think the climate crisis is serious, and doesn't have any interest in having Canada do anything but protect the tar sands, it really took a lot to get him to agree to go to Copenhagen. But his stated reason was convenient and plausible. He's very good at this, sounding plausible to most Canadians. Our targets must be realistic, they say. Realistic in the mouths of Jim Prentice and Stephen Harper means one thing: a target that will not interfere with growth in the tar sands. Realistic when we talk about it means a target sufficient to avoid runaway global warming, because the atmosphere is not interested in negotiating with humanity. There's no There's no give and take here. The carbon dioxide loading in our atmosphere is clear. Richard will talk about it. We're at more than 30% more CO2 than at any time in the last million years. And the science I've looked at, and I'm interested if Richard agrees, but the International Energy Agency certainly more than a year ago did a calculation that I think is, I've not seen anything more accurate, and it was after the fourth assessment of the IPCC, so it's fairly current, that if we don't ensure that global levels of greenhouse gas emissions peak before 2015, in other words, if they don't stop rising and start coming down before 2015 because of the long lag times in the atmosphere, we won't be able to avoid runaway global warming. So realistic to us means a strategy, a target, and a commitment that ensures the whole world starts moving away from fossil fuels and protecting forests on a very aggressive basis, very quickly. So there's different calculations. The scene in Copenhagen right now, by the way, President Obama has changed his initial announcement of when he will be appearing. He is, as most of you will know, today accepting the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, but he will be returning to Europe, to Copenhagen, for the high-level summit meeting of over 100 world leaders on Thursday and Friday of next week. So Thursday and Friday of next week, I'll be in Copenhagen attending a meeting of Global Greens. I'm attending the conference, by the way, not as a member of the Canadian delegation. The Canadian delegation, by the way, is one of the largest going to the summit. It's over 180 people. The US delegation is 190. The French, the British, the countries that are really committed to actually doing something have much smaller delegations. I think that's interesting. I am attending with accreditation through the European Greens in the European Parliament. And I will be attending a lot of sessions that involve members of Parliament, members of government. The current Minister of Environment, for instance, from the Czech Republic is a Green Party person. The current Minister of Environment from Ireland is a Green Party member of Parliament in coalition governments around the world. As you know, Greens have a lot of roles. Senator Christine Milne of Australia will be there. Wangari Maathai is already there, and people mostly know her as the first Nobel laureate to win a Peace Prize for environmental work for her work in Kenya with the Green Belt movement. But she also was one of the founders of the Kenyan Green Party. So Wangari's there already. José Bové, the French activist who first took, what farm implement was it that he took to a local McDonald's and did some damage to the McDonald's in France? He was one of the pioneers of the slow food movement. He's also a Green active member. So there'll be a lot of us there, either in Parliament, in government, or not, who are working together as Greens and trying to make a difference. And these meetings are very unusual. You actually can make a difference by working the corridors and not going to sleep. It's really quite important that if you happen to overhear somebody or chat up somebody when you're getting coffee, and somebody happens to mention from a delegation from India, that if they could only get someone to remember the way Article 3.9 read back at the negotiations in, say, Marrakesh, that would help solve everything. Then you take that kind of information and you run to people in other delegations and say, do you know the Indians would move if you could only go back to the original language from Article 3.9 from the way it read when you were in Marrakesh? These kinds of things actually move the negotiations. The best example I can give you was the negotiation of the Montreal Protocol to protect the ozone layer. A lot of people, you know, it's always, this is one of the things I want to share with you about why I'm not discouraged. I'm certainly angry, but I'm not discouraged by our lack of progress. Every campaign we've ever won in the environmental movement has been over incredible odds and over everyone telling us that if we were only realistic, if we only accepted the obvious political realities, we would realize we were asking for something impossible. So, the fight on acid rain, what was our political calculation here? The Prime Minister of Canada was Brian Mulroney. The President of the United States was Ronald Reagan. What were the chances that Brian Mulroney would make his top bilateral issue with the United States acid rain? And what were the chances that that would work, considering that Ronald Reagan had said repeatedly that acid rain was caused by ducks? So, we forget these things. Now everyone says, oh, acid rain, that was easy. Or ozone depletion. I've heard this over and over from people saying, oh, sure, it was easy to get a protocol to protect the ozone layer because the science was very clear and there weren't really any industrial interests that were opposing it. But neither of those things are true. I can tell you from having been in the negotiations for the Montreal Protocol, first of all, the science wasn't that clear. The large Antarctic ozone hole opened up after the Montreal Protocol was negotiated. You faced, and Paul Brodeur, by the way, first wrote a series of articles in the New Yorker about the way DuPont Chemical handled the initial attack on their product, chlorofluorocarbons, as a threat to all life on Earth by destroying the ozone layer. Whenever I talk about corporate social responsibility, I believe in corporate social responsibility, but I don't think it solves a whole lot, because only a few companies are ever going to be sufficiently socially responsible that you can forget about regulations and stimulus packages and sanctions and incentives and subsidies. You have to get them moving in the right direction, but the best example in the world is DuPont. Because you would think that a responsible corporation, when told that one of their leading products was initially touted as a miracle product, benign, didn't break down, so non-toxic that even the sensitive filaments of the human lung would not be harmed by a CFC molecule that delivered some asthma drug right to the, right to the lung. You know, it was a great piece of chemistry. And you could also use it, of course, for blowing in foam insulation, making styrofoam, keeping things cold in the refrigerator. Brilliant substance. And it didn't break down until it got all the way to the stratosphere. And then ultraviolet radiation from the sun could break it down. And suddenly you were liberating these chloride molecules from the chlorofluorocarbons. And the one chlorine molecule could gobble up about 80,000 ozone molecules. And suddenly you had a threat to the ozone layer. So you'd think when you went to the CEO of DuPont and explained this, that they would say, oh my gosh, one of our substances threatens all life on Earth? That can't be good for business. We better do something about that. Well, their first response, of course, and Paul Brodeur documented all this, was to say, there's nothing wrong with the ozone layer. Your readings are wrong. The second response was, a couple years later, okay, the ozone layer is thinning, but it's nothing to do with our product. Your data's wrong. The third response is, of course, all right, the ozone layer is thinning and it's because of our products, but if you force us to change, it will be a disaster for the economy and it will harm people in developing countries. It's amazing how much corporate hacks will care about developing countries at the point their product is threatened. They think that's their best argument. Monsanto's bringing out GMOs to help developing countries. Bjorn Lomborg is plagued by the thought of what happens in Africa because we're paying attention to climate change. Anyway. That was their argument. Finally, they realized that governments weren't budging. And when I say finally, we were in the lead up to the Montreal Protocol negotiations. And what DuPont had done was when Jimmy Carter was president, they thought the US government was serious. So they'd ramped up their development of an alternative to CFCs. As soon as Ronald Reagan was elected, they stopped the work. They shelved all their work on the alternatives. And there's somebody I'm going to way more detail than I meant to on this, but now that I'm thinking about it, there's an unsung hero of why we still have an ozone layer, who was a soft-spoken South Carolinian who happened to be a Republican who was made administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency in those years, and his name was Lee Thomas. And he just kept working under the radar system. The White House didn't know what he was doing. He was just going to meetings, negotiating. And it wasn't until the Montreal Protocol negotiations were, 3 weeks from happening, that suddenly the alarm bell started going off in the U.S. Inside the Beltway, that the U.S. was getting itself committed to a treaty to get rid of chlorofluorocarbons. At which point Don Hodel, who was Secretary of the Interior, announced that we didn't need any treaty like that, that the ozone thinning was perfectly manageable and all we needed was broad brim hats and sunscreen. This is true, I'm not making this up, right? Right before, and then when we got to Montreal, we were negotiating the agreement, the negotiations completely fell apart. No one was talking to anyone else, and it was the weirdest thing, because of all things, one of the problem countries is one of the countries I love the best, the Netherlands. The Netherlands suddenly, because they had a lot of chemical manufacturing going on in the Netherlands, didn't think it was gonna get sufficient market share in the alternatives once CFCs were being phased out. So it was like being in a giant trade talk. Who gets market share? No one's talking about do we defend all life on Earth. It was just quite horrific. And because Lee Thomas didn't have the support of the White House, I was running to him on behalf of my boss, and he would say, I can't do anything. I just called the White House. They said, they're not budging. So I was going to the Europeans, trying to get them. We ended up having that negotiation saved because the New Zealand Environment Minister said, how about this? What if we took it, and his little solution worked for everybody. And what it was the framework of the Kyoto Protocol. Industrialized countries go first, developing countries follow along later, and there was a distribution of the market share issue. It was negotiated in the room in Montreal. Now, after it was negotiated, I can remember thinking, well, it was a miracle. What were the odds? We started this negotiation, everybody was in different corners of the room. The interesting thing about success, and John said it breeds lots of fathers, it also develops this really strange, well, that was easy. It's always easy after you did it. It wasn't easy at the time, and that's just what I want to share. This isn't looking easy now. This is looking, in fact, harder than anything I've ever seen being negotiated. But all the times and all the other contexts when we've successfully negotiated and solved global problems, it didn't look easy at the time. And as soon as it's done, people say, oh, well. But acid rain, ozone depletion, those were easy. This is different. Well, yes and no. It's a little different because it's big, because it's fossil fuels, and mostly it's different because the people we are trying to force to shift their product line have more power and more money than any of the others we've ever dealt with. There's some of the same people. The coal lobby in the U.S. talk about the lies people make up to stop environmental progress. The coal lobby in Ohio Valley in the U.S. tried to tell U.S. congressmen and senators that there was no such thing as acid rain, that Canada had made it up. Yes, we had invented it because we wanted to sell hydro to the United States. It was an entire Quebec hydro lie, and only foolish senators and congressmen would do away with coal in the United States. Now, the technological fix there was easier. They just had to put scrubbers on the stacks. And that stopped the sulfur dioxide from killing our lakes and rivers. We don't have any equivalent end of pipeline technology. Not yet. We may someday, but carbon capture and storage isn't going to do it. So as we go into this meeting in Copenhagen, Thursday and Friday, let's just give you the end of this email I got that gave me the context, which ended by saying, knowing what I know now, I don't think I would have wanted to come here. So if I were you, I wouldn't come. Well, yes, but there's the send-off rally, you see? So I kind of have to go. The message said, Thursday, Friday, we're expecting 100 leaders of governments around the world, each of whom will speak for 5 minutes. There are 40,000 participants registered with accreditation to get inside the convention. Like me, I have my accreditation. 40,000. 5,000 media. The convention center has a capacity for 15,000. This is going to be very interesting. And as I said, and then there's for the first time, and this is one of the messages, that there's this time the potential I've never sensed before a climate set of conferences. I mean, I've been to a WTO meetings, and you know at WTO meetings that there's a large likelihood of tear gas moving like a weather system through whatever city you're in. Never at a climate talk. This is feeling a little different. For one thing, people are angrier. I don't know if you heard what Tuvalu did. A small, low-lying island state, Tuvalu, for the first time, not only played the game of being angry as the developing world at the rich guys, Tuvalu stood up and said, yes, the US, the industrialized world, has to take on targets and has to reduce emissions. And so do China and India. Now that just never happened. The North-South divide at the UN is usually pretty clear. Tuvalu stood on different grounds. Today there was a demonstration of the youth there, and the Africans are saying the same thing. And the slogan is becoming, we do not die quietly. So having been in years and years and years and years of climate negotiations, when we had time on our side, chances to implement, you know, emissions targets that we could do gradually, we're now down to the wire. Because we know that if emissions don't stop rising by 2015, given the time lags in the atmosphere, it may well be too late to avoid 3 degrees global average temperature increase, which goes to 4, which goes to 5, which goes to 6, and so on. So there's a different dynamic happening right now. And my message from my friend who's already there ended by saying, it's hard to believe that anything in the world like this even exists. It's either an act of enormous heroism or it's just frightening. So I see this as like this standing at this moment where it could go either way. I remember in the Montreal negotiations back in 2005 at COP11, which was the only time that a climate negotiation ever happened in North America. And some of you will remember my old friend Mike Duffy, now in the Senate. But I actually went through, you know, left the convention center in Montreal to do whatever it was, 5 p.m. on the Friday night, the last day of the conference, to do an interview with Mike Duffy. And I was, of course, not with the Green Party, I was with Sierra Club. He was a little nicer to me then. And he said, so, Elizabeth, was it a success or a failure? I said, well, we don't know. It's too early to tell. Nothing's been decided yet. Because all the issues end up being linked. So you negotiate for 2 weeks, and then the questions of will people agree to, and now in Montreal the issue was, will we agree to negotiate targets and deadlines and a second phase of Kyoto to kick in the minute that the first phase of Kyoto 2008 to 2012 ends. Montreal, that meeting, was what put in motion the meeting that's going on now. It was we decided in Montreal in 2005 that the deadline for negotiations to replace the first phase of Kyoto had to be 2009, COP15. No one knew it would take place in Copenhagen, but it was 2009 since 2005. And I remember sitting there and Mike Duffy made some kind of snide remark about Paul Martin taking shots at George Bush and wasn't that political. And I should also say parenthetically, I've never been so proud in my life to be Canadian as when Paul Martin addressed the opening session of that COP11 conference and made it clear that we had a moral responsibility and industrialized countries had to go first. And even though Canada had not lived up to its commitments, we would do so. And that the fact that it was difficult was no excuse for inaction. And I've never seen a UN meeting where everyone leapt to their feet cheering. It was just amazing. We were all pretty excited. And I've never been a liberal. I say this again publicly. So anyway, I went there. I was with Mike Duffy taking the shot at Paul Martin. And I got so mad at him. I actually said, Mike, I don't think you understand. The fate of the whole world depends on these negotiations. We're in a deadlock right now. And it could go either way. So I never have done this on TV before or since. So if anyone's listening who actually prays, I'd like to ask you to pray now, because this could go either way. And he suddenly stopped being mean to me. He said, oh, thank you, Elizabeth. That was very important information. Thank you very much. So I went, and I had a lot of friends email me from around the country saying, we started praying. Oh, anyway, that worked, against all odds. So I go into these things thinking, yeah, it looks bad. Yes, it's not great that the Danish delegation was putting around a draft text that would abandon the Kyoto framework and not protect developing countries and move just with industrialized interests first. I'm assuming a fair degree of familiarity in everyone in the room with these kinds of issues. But the fact it came out on the second day of the conference, and it's all out in the open. If that were to have emerged on day 15, we couldn't pull it together. But as things now stand, it could go either way. We've got heroes in that room. I never thought I'd believe it, but Nicolas Sarkozy is a hero. He's working very closely with President Lula of Brazil. The low-lying island state leadership, they're heroes. There are people in that room who are, Gordon Brown, there are people who are leaders of major nations around this world who are simply not going to accept failure. And the youth in the streets are not going to accept failure either. So in the next 10, 11 days, please do keep up the pressure. I'm taking the letters that people have brought me here today with me to Copenhagen to prepare and present to either Jim Prentice or Stephen Harper when I can find them. But using the Prime Minister's phone line, 992-4211, 613-992-4211, call it a lot in the next few days. What are you doing in Copenhagen? Are we going to help? Are we going to be on the right side of this? Yes. 613-992-4211. No, it's not a toll-free number. You can call collect. you can also pay attention to the various websites for the Chronicle Herald, the Globe and Mail, the National Post, every CBC, CTV. Every time there's a story about climate, I'm absolutely convinced there are paid fossil fuel denier industry people who log on and write nasty things right away to discourage other people from posting their own comments. So we have to be prepared for that. You have to write back. And you also have to continue to pressure the your member of parliament, the prime minister's office. It really does matter. And for those that are doing a good job, give them some encouragement.
After Ms. May, a brief talk was given by Richard Zarowski, who spoke about climate catastrophes in the Earth's distant past. Zarowski, a local meteorologist and author of the Maritime Book of Climate Change and the Book of Maritime Weather, used these examples to place into context the dangers of runaway global climate change and the role of popular science education and science professionals in the process of climate negotiations.
My first love is science, and this is all about science. The science of climate change, and first of all, I'm not going to call it climate change anymore, I'm going to call it global warming. There's an interesting little anecdote about why it's called climate change in the United States and why it's called climate change in Canada. And in the United States, during the George Bush years, of course, they've got all their media people polling what people think, and they thought, you know, global warming, if you're living down in Arizona or Nevada, global warming doesn't sound good, so let's call it climate change. Let's make it sound nice and benign. Climate change could mean anything. It could mean a natural process. It could mean something that occurs naturally. It could be warming or cooling, and so you're not really certain about what it is. And that's the American approach, so they tried to mitigate it. In Canada, we came at it from a different place. Environment Canada was looking at the word global warming, and they said, gee, you know, Canada, just go outside in some December or January, February. Most Canadians would say, global warming, well, that's a gosh darn good thing to have. So we're going to call it climate change. And I think that used to typify the difference between Canadians and Americans before we got this current government, which became sort of an appendix to the American point of view. And this really is about the science. And as I'm thinking about this, I go back to think about how long the tapestry of life that we are part of has existed on the Earth. It's been here for almost 4 billion years in an unbroken chain to our point. And we run the risk of putting an end to all of it. And I'll tell you why we run the risk. There are two times in the last 4 billion years, not talking about this current crisis, where the climate has been so onerous that life almost died. The first time was something called Snowball Earth, and that happened about a billion years ago. And we had all these wonderful little anaerobes, single-cell creatures, that proliferated and just lived off. The carbon dioxide content in the Earth at that time was about 90%. So they had a lot to eat. They were also photosynthetic, so they ate it, they metabolized it, they used the energy of the sun to break it down, and they created oxygen. Now, if you know a little bit of chemistry, you know that oxygen is the second most reactive chemical on the periodic table. If it wasn't good for us, it would kill us. Well, as it happened, anaerobes are named anaerobes because they don't like oxygen. They can't metabolize it, but they do produce it. They munch up all the carbon dioxide, they take in the sunlight, and they metabolize very, very slowly, but they spit out oxygen. Well, what happened is the oxygen level started to go up, and the chemical reaction started to take place, and the oxygen got buried in iron and in the crust and in the oceans till the point that it was filled. And then it started to go into the atmosphere. And then they started to do themselves out of an environment. Sound familiar? And what happened is that when you take the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, you have to remember the sun was 25% less bright than it is today. And so that means they needed that carbon dioxide to keep the atmosphere nice and toasty. And what they did was they ate up their environment till the climate changed. They didn't get global warming, what they got was a cooling. And the cooling was so dramatic that we had something called Snowball Earth. And Snowball Earth was entirely frozen. Scientists speculate, the paleontologists who look at the climate structures of that time, speculate that the ice was 100 meters thick even in the tropical oceans. So the entire Earth froze. And they did themselves out of an ecosystem, and the anaerobes pretty much killed themselves off because they lived in giant mats called, like stromatolites, which are found in the salt bays in Australia. And they lived in these giant mats on the ocean. But the good news is that we had something called plate tectonics. So they died out. Plate tectonics kept happening. Carbon dioxide went back up into the atmosphere. It went up again. And within about a few thousand years, things warmed up. It was nice and toasty again. All the ecosystems were open. And bingo, life progressed again. So that was episode number one. We had a global cooling. Episode number two happened 251 million years ago, and it was called the Great Dying. And this is the one that really concerns me because it deals with a runaway greenhouse effect. Now, when we talk about extinctions in the what's called the Phanerozoic over the last 540 million years, we talk about this one as being the big one. 75% of all species on land and 90% to 95% of all ocean species died out. And we don't know why they died out, but we think we have a good idea. There was something called the Siberian Traps, and this was named after a geologist, a Swedish geologist, who went through Siberia and found these great lava domes in central Siberia. Now, if you speak a Germanic language, you know that the word Treppe means steps. And in Swedish, they were called Treppe, which means a series of steps. And we wound up in English calling them traps. And so we have the Deccan Traps in India, which are created by volcanoes. And we've got the Siberian Traps, which are the world's largest in Siberia. And when we date them, we find that they happened about 251 million years ago. And they lasted for about 100,000 years. And in that time, a huge area, about half the size of Canada, was covered in lava and basalt to 3,000 feet. Almost a mile of this stuff. And they figure there was so much carbon dioxide that went into the atmosphere, the temperature climbed catastrophically. It was probably one of the very warmest periods in the Earth's history. Here's what happened to the oceans. The carbon dioxide levels went up. The oceans started to heat and started to belch out additional gases. Methane, which we're hearing about right now. Other nitrous oxides, which we're hearing about right now. And these contributed to the warming of the Earth. But something else that it belched out was something called hydrogen cyanide. It's an awful, awful gas. It's a silage gas. And you hear about it in Saskatchewan and prairie places where farmers go into their silos and die. It kills you in about 30 seconds. Well, this was a byproduct of the dying animals in the ocean because of the heating. Oxygen levels fell in the ocean. You wound up with anoxic regions where there's no oxygen. And so all the species, most of the species in the ocean all died off, 95% of them. And we couldn't understand why species on land would die. Well, the temperature went up, desertification increased because it was one continent. Coastal areas were inundated by this awful poison called hydrogen cyanide. Well, the latest stuff that is frightening me is, and if you look at Scientific American, if you look at Nature magazine, if you look at Science magazine, you'll see the science is there. We're increasing the global atmospheric average of carbon dioxide, which is the principal greenhouse gas, by about 2 to 3% a year. Right now we're at 387 parts per million and climbing. Now we're, as Elizabeth said, about 30% higher than we've been in a million years. So we're pushing this boundary. And I first bumped into runaway greenhouse effect 35 years ago when my undergraduate professor in atmospheric physics came in and said, I'm going to talk about a runaway greenhouse effect because I've just gone to a lecture on this. And I thought he was talking about the planet Venus. He was talking about the Earth. We were talking about this 35 years ago. The science was there 35 years ago, talking about how things change when you put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And so now we're finding that the levels are going up. They're 30% higher than they should be. And as Elizabeth said, we have maybe 5 or 10 years to reverse that process before science takes care of things. And science doesn't care whether we have rhetoric, whether the media agrees with us, whether the deniers can find little holes in emails someplace that they don't like, which, by the way, is an amazing crock that the media has bought into. The science is there. We know since Arrhenius's time, which was 160 years ago, that carbon dioxide leads to a warming of the atmosphere. It triggers other gases like methane, like the nitrous oxides and the other oxides that will add to the heating, and catastrophic things can happen. So the science is very, very clear. So why don't we do more? Well, it has to do with our media. There's a war on science going on right now. The war on science is profound. It goes into every area. If you take a look at our media, if you take a look at our movies, I just watched a movie last night. My wife and I went to the video store and rented it. It was the one with Will Smith called I, Robot. And guess who the problem is? It's the scientist. The scientist creates the mad monster. The other movie that he did was also equally indicative was Legend. People, scientists create the problem, and it's the inspired hero comes out and solves that problem. Well, the media wants you to believe that science is bad. Well, science has given us so much, and it's telling us now that we're using up too many of our resources, and it's telling us that we're putting too much of our effluent into the atmosphere. And the only thing that's going to solve this is science. So I'll leave you with that. I'll leave you with the media, the history of the Earth, the billions of years of tapestry of life on the planet Earth, and the fact that we're jeopardizing all of it. It rests on the shoulders of people like Elizabeth. It rests on the shoulders of people like Prime Minister Rudd from Australia, trying to bring in some sort of cap, some sort of tax, some sort of end to the carbon dioxide. So whether you're an atheist or religious, or whether you're going to fast or complain or phone, this is our time to do something. This is the time not to have another great dying. Thank you.